Welcome to Discovering and Sharing Shuswap History.
The Burt Noakes Family by Estelle Noakes. Albert Victor Noakes was born in Victoria, B.C. in 1911. His parents were Harold and Florence, and he had one brother, Stan, 2 years older. The Noakes family moved to the North Shuswap in 1912. Florence Noakes was a schoolteacher. Bert and Stan were at times homeschooled, and when Florence was teaching, they would go to school with her at a very young age. Both were taught music at an early age and played in the Noakes family band. Stan played the violin, viola, and banjo, and Bert the saxophone. For both, music was a sustaining love for the rest of their lives. The Noakes home was filled with musical instruments and their other love, books. Bert left the Shuswap during the Depression years. He traveled around Canada, playing in any musical venues he could find. That was the big band era. During a playing engagement in Edmonton, he met his future wife, Helen Valletta Kreiderman. Helen, a big city girl, had been brought up in Edmonton. She had been to business college, worked in an office, and played the piano for the church symphony. She was also involved in her community and taught CGIT. On June 22, 1937, Bert and Helen were married. Helen then followed the band, living in many prairie cities. Daughter Jeanette was born in Edmonton, followed by twins Irene and Iris, and myself in Saskatoon. Bert joined the Canadian Air Force. He went through basic training and wanted to go on to be a pilot. The Air Force had other plans for him, and he spent the war years playing in the Air Force band, which involved much travel. Helen went to live in a cabin at Mamio Beach, just outside Edmonton, until 1944, when she joined Bert in Regina, and that's where my first brother Gerald was born. Bert left the forces in 1945 and brought his family back to the Shuswap. Unfortunately, he had lost part of his hearing and thought that he would not be able to play music in his accustomed manner. In later years, four more children were born, Harold in 1946, followed by Alva and Doris, and then their last son, David, in 1951. Bert worked in various jobs, mostly in logging, but his love was always music. The family lived in various places around the Shuswap. One was the old Thompson place. From there, the four older girls went to Magna Bay School and were taught by their grandmother, Florence Noakes. Estelle was in grade one, and on one cold winter day, she got behind the others, got tired, and sat down in the snow. Glenn Prigmore found her there, wrapped her in his coat, and took her home. Whenever he saw her throughout the years, he would remind her that she owed him her life. Another place the family lived in was the old Lynn place, now owned by Larry Speed. They were living there when Helen's mother decided to come for a visit. There was great consternation, however, as Grandma didn't know about Harold and Alva. Helen hadn't known how to tell her that she had two more children. Grandma came, and she was a great sport, although there was a little concern when Irene and Iris were caught playing with a bear cub. She didn't think it ladylike either for the older girls to sit on the roof, competing in a cherry pit spitting contest, or to be collecting toads and snakes to put in Helen's wash tub when she wasn't using it. But all in all, the visit went well. Sam the workhorse was instrumental in building the log home on Meadow Creek Road. One of the daughters would ride Sam forward, allowing Bert to pivot a log in place. There were a few narrow misses, but eventually the house was built. The building took longer than expected, forcing the family to live over the winter in a makeshift slab shack that was built as a summer shelter. The shack was flimsy and higher up in the front, leaving the floor exposed. Once, when Speed's bull wandered into the yard, Bert had the children remain quiet until the bull left, just in case the bull charged the building. During the summer spent in the slab shack, Helen had some canned meat that had gone bad. She gave it to one of the girls to bury and then asked them to cover it with ashes. Unfortunately, there were still some embers in the ashes. The spark traveled up a tree root and soon the whole mountain was on fire. Everyone in the community came to fight the fire, and to this day, no one has forgotten that the Noakes children set the mountain on fire. The log home was not ready when winter came, and the Noakses wintered in the slab shack. The next year, they finally moved into their log home, and no one was more thankful than Helen. On their property, they had some livestock, mostly goats, Sam the horse, a dog, and many cats. Farming was never a successful endeavor for the Noakes family. Helen and Bert were both conservationists. Killing anything was difficult for them. And then there were 9 children trying to make pets out of every animal. They tried raising a pig, and that became quite a disaster. The pig was named Wally, after Wally the school bus driver. As the pig got bigger, he found out where the milk came from, and would chase the goats until he cornered them and could help himself. There was a lot of noisy protest from the goats and very little milk left at milking time. Soon, Wally had to go. Bert logged on his property. Sam the horse was a contrary animal and often would sit down on the trail. And the only way to stop this habit was for one of the girls to ride him. All the older daughters went logging at times with their father. Bert's intentions, I'm sure, were not to harmonize with Chum, the border collie. He didn't really have a choice. Many evenings, Bert would get out his saxophone and Chum would position himself under the nearest window. When Bert began, so did Chum. Bert would often ask the girls to bribe Chum away with food, but the dog was never bribed away with mere food, so they would carry on together. Coyotes would howl back from the surrounding hills, alerting dogs at each farm, until everyone down the valley would know that Bert Noakes was playing his horn. Sometimes the 4 older girls would stay too long and be caught in the dark when visiting at Speed's. They would walk home, holding hands, and when the one on the end would fall in the ditch, they would correct their path. Once, they had wandered past their own gate, when they heard their father playing his horn and Chum joining in, they soon found their way home. Helen had few visitors, but those that stopped by were often interesting. Sometimes a priest would stop in pushing his bicycle. The older girls wondered why he always pushed it. So one day they hid down the road when he was leaving. As he got past the gate, he lifted up his skirt, exposing his skinny legs, and rode off, followed by a chorus of giggles. There were many old bachelors, too, and they were always invited in for a meal. Helen never had the heart to turn anyone away, even when food was limited, as it often was. Those were very tough times for Helen and Bert, especially Helen, who did not adjust well to living in the bush. Both worked hard, had high ideals, and tried their best to live a life of integrity, and instill the same in their children. Visits to town were rare, as they did not own a vehicle. The 4 older Noakes girls cut and carried in wood, milked the goats, looked after the young ones, and performed many chores that were difficult for young girls. Once when Helen decided they were old enough to be left with the younger children, she went to town with some neighbors. While she was gone, the girls decided to help her by ironing. The clothes in those days were all cotton, crinkled easily, and needed to be sprinkled with water, rolled up and left for a few hours, then tackled with the sad irons. Taking turns, the ironing was done in no time and hung up. There were many perfect brown sad iron marks on many of them. Although Helen thanked the girls, she made it a point to have the ironing up to date before she left the next time. When the parents were gone, the girls would bring in the goats for a little visit, but the goats soon got too curious and would have to be ushered out. Helen always wondered why those darn goats were hanging around the door and wanting in. Sometimes the goats would decide to go up the mountain behind the house. The older girls would need to go and bring them back. This usually took all day and was enjoyed by both goats and children. When it was time to go home, one of the girls, usually Iris, the bravest, would go and sit on the edge of the cliff. The goats couldn't stand that and would run forward to butt her off. The trick was to catch them first. The goats ate pretty well anything, including the chinking in the log home. A fall chore was to find moss, mix it with mud, and re-chink the logs. Everyone enjoyed this chore, and usually were so dirty they needed to dunk in the rain barrel to clean up. Once the health nurse appeared at this time and was quite appalled because the children had no clothes on. After that, Alberta Speed would send one of her children to warn Helen, as the health nurse always stopped there first. The little school at Meadow Creek had only 10 students. They included Noakes, Speeds, Chambers, Rasmussens, and Barnetts. It was only one room with a horse barn and the biffy outside. There was a water bucket and a dipper at the back and a barrel stove with a rail around in the middle. The rail in winter was always full of steaming clothes drying. One of the older students would go early, start the fire, and bring in the water. One spring day, the teacher was late. It took only one person to say she wasn't coming for all the students to agree to play hooky. They went to Speed's. The Speed's parents had gone to town, and they played baseball, climbed up the cliffs, and went home at the usual time. The community Christmas concert was looked forward to for months. The four oldest Noakes girls would sing together. Bert was their coach, but he was a self-proclaimed atheist, so the songs were not in keeping with Christmas. Some of them were Silver Threads Among the Gold, When I Grow Too Old to Dream, and Little Brown Jug. The concert was held in the hall, and everyone came, including Santa. Each child received a gift and a bag of candy. May Day was a fun day also, with local royalty and the Maypole Dance. The Noakes girls were part of the royalty on more than one occasion. Hoping to find more music opportunities, the Noakes family moved to Winfield in 1952. But work was scarce in the Okanagan Valley, and after 4 years, they moved again to Prince George. Bert worked in various jobs, retiring from the city of Prince George in 1976. The Noakes set up an advertising business in 1958, and Helen ran this business for many years. Bert always taught music, creating his own lessons for his students. His band, the Gaslighters, was well known in Prince George. He played in symphonies and in other bands well into his 80s. At the age of 85, Bert was still going over to play for the old folks at a local seniors' home. Helen, never a healthy person, died in 1984. Bert remarried that same year to Lillian MacDonald, one of Helen's childhood friends. Bert and Lillian lived in Edmonton until 1992, when poor health necessitated their moving back to Prince George to be near family. Lillian died in 1996. Daughter Iris died in a car accident in 1988. Bert passed away in 2000. With his saxophone by his side, he had played a tune that very morning. Except for Estelle, who moved to Chase in 1981 and now lives in Enderby, the rest of Bert and Helen Noakes' family still reside around Prince George.
Why Do They Call It? By Philip and Helen Akrig. Adams River and Adams Lake, properly. Adams, Adam being Salhotkin, a Shuswap Indian chief who was baptized Adam by Father Nobili in 1849. Albus, after Al Bass, an early trapper here. Anglemont, The settlement took its name from nearby Angle Mountain. Anstey Arm. Francis Senior Anstey, the first large-scale logger on Shuswap Lake, had a camp on Anstey Arm in the early 1880s. Blind Bay. Among the meanings of blind is concealed from sight. Because of the angle at which this bay joins Shuswap Lake, it is easy to travel down the lake without noticing the bay. Canoe. So named either because the Indians found here excellent logs out of which to make their dugouts, or because of the fine beach on which to land canoes. Sallista. In 1908, when local settlers could not agree on a suitable name, postal authorities suggested the new community be named Sallista Creek, which is miles away at the northwest end of Seymour Arm. This name is an anglicized form of a well-known Shuswap ancestral name, Sallista. Prominent in this family was William Sallista, a native doctor who died in the 1940s. Chase. After Whitfield Chase, who in 1865 became the first white settler in the area. Sinamusun Narrows. Shuswap Indian name meaning come and go back again or at the bend. Copper Island. So named in 1865 by Walter Moberly when he found traces of copper on its southwest corner. The island Shuswap Indian name, anglicized as Humtakwa, means something sitting in the water. Enderby. In 1887, Mrs. George Laws was having some friends in for tea. The river, now called Shuswap, was in flood, moving one of the ladies to recite a poem by Jean Ingelow. The high tide on the coast of Lincolnshire, this begins. The old mare climbed the belfry tower. The ringers rang by twos, by threes. Pull if you've never pulled before. Good ringers, pull your best, quote he. Play up, play up, O Boston bells. Play all your changes, play all your swells. Play up, quote the brides of Enderby. The musical name of Enderby so enchanted the ladies that they decided to make that the name of their settlement.
The Thomas Wampum Belt, or Ceremonial Sash, by Estelle Noakes, read by Patty Doherty. Wampum belts are traditional sacred shell bead belts made by the Eastern Woodland Tribes of North America. For these tribes, the weaving of wampum belts was a way of recording information using color and designs, which denoted different ideas, stories, or legends. The 6-foot-long belts were used as gifts in ceremonies, celebrations, and treaties. The Thomas belt is not a true wampum belt, although designed similar to one. It is more a ceremonial sash, and it is a cultural symbol for the Thomas family. Louis Thomas is the third eldest of Dr. Mary Thomas's 17 children, and he is the present custodian of the sash, as well as an Esconlet leader and cultural educator. Mary was a respected and revered native elder who worked tirelessly as a teacher and speaker to retain the native cultural traditions and bridge the gap between natives and non-natives. Her other concerns were the environment and youth. Mary was a natural, gifted speaker. She never planned what she was going to say. She could make people laugh or cry, as she always spoke from the heart. A gentle, humble lady, she was awarded numerous accolades and 2 doctorates. Mary was instrumental in creating the Switzmalf Cultural Center in Salmon Arm. The Thomas ceremonial sash was designed and created by Mary's mother, Christine Pierisch, in the early 1900s. The sash utilizes bone, glass, and brass beads instead of shells. It does not have the storytelling aspect of the Eastern wampum belts. William Pierisch, Christine's father, traded for the bone beads from the Nakota Stoney Indian tribe of Morley, Alberta. William gave the beads to Christine, who was adept at beading, leatherwork, and basketry. Mary supposed that furs would have been the trade commodities. The glass and brass beads are of European origin and were traded for by Mary's grandfather from Father Lejeune in Kamloops. Cured pelts were the usual trade item for beads. One pelt would trade for a small handful of glass beads. Numerous furs would have been required in trade for the beads used in this beautiful sash. Christine threaded it with sinew, probably deer, and used pieces of leather to separate the links. She later presented the belt to her husband, Daniel Allen, as a gift. Mary Thomas inherited the piece and re-threaded the belt with new sinew. She wore the sash on special occasions and used it for her cultural demonstrations at schools and for her speaking engagements. Christine was instrumental in keeping the indigenous customs and traditions alive. She passed on her knowledge of the cultural ways to her daughter, Mary. Many of Mary's baskets, beadwork, and leatherwork, as well as the ceremonial sash, are displayed at the Switzmalf Cultural Center. Lewis Thomas was devoted to his mother and shared her passion for the preservation of the native culture. He says he was the builder and she was the teacher, and they learned from each other. Lewis became her companion and driver on her numerous speaking engagements and school visits. Mary's daughter, Dolores, became her caregiver in her later years. 12 of Mary's children still remain, as well as at least 5 whom she adopted. All of them, including grandchildren and great-grandchildren, are dedicated to the continuation of the work of Dr. Mary Thomas. Lewis teaches in the schools, as well he is the builder and also works with the tanning of leathers and drying fish. Lona carries on Mary's work with medicinal plants and is the expert on pit cooking. Harold is adept at birch bark baskets. Jane and Dolores work with pine needles, baskets, and bulrush mats. Lloyd is a master of drying fish. Bonnie is the president of the Switzmalf Cultural Society. Gary is the carpenter and built the lovely box that holds the ceremonial sash. Dr. Mary Thomas passed away in 2007. The legacy passed down from Christine and Mary rests in the able hands of their descendants, who treasure and honor their memories with their ongoing guardianship of indigenous traditions and cultural customs. Mary's family work and share their knowledge at the Switzmalt Cultural Center, keeping her dream alive.
The geography of the Shuswap never ceases to intrigue me, as there are always new topics to investigate, areas to explore and compare, and issues to understand. Some of our key features are the lakes, but aside from the ones adjacent to highways and communities, most of us have little knowledge about the many lakes hidden in the hills and mountains. Central to our region is Shuswap Lake, which at 290 square kilometers ranks as the province's 10th largest water body. The Shuswap's next largest lake, Adams Lake, scores a bit higher in the record books, as it is BC's second deepest lake and the 24th deepest on Earth at 450 meters deep, which is 93 meters less than Quesnel Lake. Just how many lakes are there in the Shuswap? After studying the maps, it becomes apparent that one would need to consider only those lakes large enough to rate more than a passing glance, as there are a plethora of small, high-elevation lakes. Using the 106-hectare Gardam Lake as the approximate minimum size for enumeration purposes, I counted 34 large and medium-sized lakes in the Shuswap watershed. This number is far less than adjacent regions, the Thompson and Caribou. For comparison purposes, those lakes that are either partially or entirely protected in provincial parks could be deemed significant because there's less chance that these lakes will suffer negative impacts from human activities. The largest of these is Hunnequa Lake, the key part of the Anstey-Hunnequa Provincial Park, which was created in the year 2000 after many years of conservation efforts and land use planning processes. It could also be one of the largest low-elevation, non-roaded lakes protected in the province and possibly the largest throughout the entire Pacific Northwest. Other Shuswap area lakes include White Lake, Greenbush Lake, Momish Lakes, Upper Harbor Lake, and Tum Tum Lake. There are also some very small protected lakes, including Grizzly Lake in Puquiashin Park and Spectrum, Peters, and Margie Lakes in Monashie Park. While park status does offer greater ecological protection, it offers no help from the onslaught of climate change impacts, such as forest fires and insects. In the summer of 2009, Momish Lake Park was devastated after a forest fire burnt nearly every tree. The campsites there are now closed, and the road is unsafe due to the threat of landslides. Sport fishing is the reason people visit many of Shuswap's smaller lakes, although this sport has declined in popularity during the last few decades. It is not the lack of trout, however, that the sport is declining, as many lakes are restocked by the Fish and Wildlife branch every year. At one time, fishing lodges dotted many Shuswap lakes, but these were forced to close when the forest industry insisted the lodges take out expensive insurance to cover the cost of any timber that might be burned by a forest fire started by one of their clients. Some of those most popular fishing lakes are White Lake, Adams Lake, Arthur Lake, and tiny Joyce Lake near Falkland. Another way to enjoy Shuswap lakes is to camp next to one, as there are over 50 lakeside recreation sites scattered throughout the region. Some lakes are more suitable for those that appreciate camping away from the crowds, such as Greenbush Lake and Hummamilt Lake, both of which are perfect for canoeing or kayaking. For the real wilderness experience, there are many alpine lakes without road access and many without names, such as the group of lakes north of Eagle Pass Mountain and near Grace Mountain. Perhaps the least known lakes in the Shuswap are the ones found in the Aberdeen Plateau, an area that most people think is part of the Okanagan. Water from Grizzly, Spex, Hato, and Aberdeen lakes flow into Detu Creek, then into Bassett Creek, and finally into the Shuswap River, except for the flow destined for Vernon area residents and farmers. In the 1920s, these lakes were converted into reservoirs for irrigation. There are 8 rec sites in just this one area, and many more at nearby lakes that drain into the Okanagan. Perhaps the least known of any of the mid-sized Shuswap area lakes is the unnamed lake that drains into Meadow Creek, which feeds into Cayenne Creek, and eventually flows into the Momish system and then into Adams Lake.
For more information on these and other stories, please contact the Salmon Arm Museum at Haney Heritage Park or visit us when we are open during the summer season.
The Salmon Arm Bay Nature Enhancement Society, also known as SABNIS, then and now. Believe it or not, some residents of Salmon Arm have never hiked the nature trail along the Salmon Arm Bay waterfront. Perhaps a little history will enlighten them and encourage those who know it well to appreciate it even more. Before the 1980s, today's foreshore trail was non-existent. The undisturbed bush along the south end of Shuswap Lake, between what is now the Wharf and Raven subdivision, was impassable to most. The bay adjacent to this area is a shallow estuary of the Salmon River, where a food chain dwells. Water-tolerant grasses feed and shelter invertebrates, which feed yearling salmon and other fish. Those small fish provide food for the threatened grebe population and other waterfowl. Both then and now, in spring and fall, the bay becomes a resting and feeding area for migratory birds. Without management during many years before 1980, the mudflats along the wharf at low water had become spear fishing sites, if you can believe it, and marshes used as dumping grounds. In the mid-1980s, the BC government realized the tourism potential in catering to the public's new interest in travel to places for hiking, biking, nature viewing, and birding. Money was allocated for specialized development throughout the province, including Salmon Arm. In 1986, Vic Bates, president of Triple S Development Limited, bought 68 acres of land along Salmon Arm Bay. He planned to develop about half for his residential, commercial, and tourist commercial projects and designate the remainder as a wildlife reserve. various parcels of land owned by the city, developers such as Vic Bates, and the provincial government under the BC Nature Trust were negotiated to establish a continuous trail. Further complicating trail designation were certain restrictions by CP Rail, which ran parallel to the proposed trail. After a year of intense efforts by hundreds of members of the community, local organizations, and various levels of government, an agreement was put in place to establish a nature reserve. Upon the recommendation of the Shuswap Naturalist Club, the province declared this expanse of land and marsh a provincial wildlife sanctuary. Thanks to the Clark's grebe and the endangered western grebes nesting in the area, the land also was designated as a federal migratory bird sanctuary. Since then, the naturalists have identified 230 bird species around the bay. BC has a total of 480, so that's almost half. Once designated, such a large area needed managing. At the 1988 SABNIS AGM, Vic Bates donated $25,000 for setting up a management plan for the 27-acre sanctuary. The SABNIS mandate was 1. To ensure that the 4 kilometers of designated shoreline would be preserved forever. 2. To regulate human and dog access to the sanctuary. And 3. To provide education for school groups and visitors to the sanctuary via guided walks and the ever-evolving nature center. A year later, the land base increased unexpectedly. The city received a $1.5 million government grant to improve Marine Park, which included dredging the lake to accommodate more watercraft in the marina below the wharf. 40,000 cubic meters of gravel were trucked along the Nature Reserve shore and dumped at the grass line to form a four-sided dike to house the dredged material. Dredgeate, it's called. This addition increased the reserve by 16.5 acres and became known as Christmas Island, named for SABNIS member Eric Christmas. The truck route became the basis for the main multipurpose walkway bicycle route through the protected area. By 1993, volunteers and funded experts had enhanced Christmas Island by sculpting lagoons and mounds and planting native vegetation. The Nature Society erected a bird viewing tower and boardwalk. A grebe colony proved the success of Christmas Island by producing 158 young, a new record to that date. Worldwide birders traveled to Salmon Arm to observe the grebe's unique courting behavior and to witness the young being carried on their parents' backs. It wasn't long before SABNIS received a federal environmental award. Site improvement continued. Ducks Unlimited completed the major project of providing fencing to protect cottonwood and willow growth, which would ensure forest succession for nesting wood ducks and other birds. In May 1995, an interpretive center, later renamed the Brighouse Nature Interpretive Center, was opened. The city and other grant funding bodies provide summer employment for student interpreters. Although city naturalists feared the building of the Prestige Inn would interfere with wildlife habitat, compromises were made. The city built walkway promenades east and west of the wharf for wildlife and landscape viewing and added osprey platforms. A well-attended naturalist convention held at the Prestige Inn and a full-scale grebe festival further spread word of the Nature Reserve's wildlife observation opportunities. Management has not been without problems, however. The 2 bird blinds built by the Naturalist Club were destroyed by vandals, and the bird observation tower is threatened by water damage and weather every year. The boardwalks require yearly maintenance to ensure safety underfoot. When beavers moved in, they built a lovely lagoon, but attacked the willows for dam building and food. Upkeep is ongoing. The naturalists and SABNIS members hold spring and summer work bees to remove and trim vegetation, plant and water trees, pull invasive plants, and reposition buoys that designate nesting areas of the bay that are off-limits to boaters. The city maintains a toilet and rejuvenates the trail with gravel. So thanks to the knowledge of forward-thinking local naturalists, city land developers, 11 municipal, 9 provincial, and 10 federal government departments, Salmon Arm is now showcased as a major tourist location and the trail a preferred walk in all seasons. This small city is unique in that it has a nature reserve at its heart. So the next time you take your visiting friends and relatives for a walk down the foreshore trail, you might choose to share some of the reserve's history, visit the interpretive center, and appreciate that this special slice of landscape is maintained by groups of enthusiastic volunteers. SABNIS survives on memberships, donations, and corporate sponsorships. Have a look at the interpretive signage along the nature trail to realize the extent of the species you might encounter. Each time you visit, you will experience something different. The rumbling trains, you say? The wildlife has adjusted to them, so we can't complain. Judith Benson thanks Tom Brighouse for his expertise and the archival information he provided for this historical account.
Evelyn Daniels was married to Frank Daniels. Frank was a son of Victoria and Forrest Daniels, who were the first settlers of Seymour Arm. This story was written by Bal Crampton, who was a niece of Evelyn Daniels, and it was edited by myself, Estelle Noakes. Auntie Evelyn was widowed in August of 1926 when Uncle Frank Daniels died after an appendectomy. Uncle Frank and his brothers had been woodsmen and operated a sawmill down at Shuswap Lake for many years. Having to fend for herself, she left their comfortable log house, located about 3/4 of a mile up the mountainside, at the very end of the Seymour Arm off Shuswap Lake. Auntie Evelyn came out to the prairies, as did her son Ralph, who was maybe 16, and they traveled around for a couple of years, working on farms, cooking for harvest crews, housekeeping in the winter, and so forth. The fall of 29 was especially rough, and after several unsuccessful ventures, Auntie Evelyn found herself after the harvest with nowhere to go and only the few dollars she had managed to scrimp out of her harvest wages. Ralph also found no work, and in desperation they pooled their resources to pay their way back to Seymour Arm, where they would at least have a roof over their heads, albeit no livelihood. There was fare for the train to Sicamuse, and a few sandwiches to eat on the way, then the ferry up the lake, just as it was freezing over, and finally the 3/4 mile hike up the mountainside with their few effects. As they stepped through the last trees into the clearing, despair overwhelmed them. No house, only a pile of snow-covered ashes. Auntie Evelyn was not a woman to be discouraged for very long. The problems were simple. They were there. They had no money. To get away from there, the answer was just as simple. They would build a new house and stay there. They assessed the pros. The house had been built on a concrete slab, which had not been heavily damaged by the fire. The iron stove still stood, warped, but useful. They had removed the windows before leaving the house, and they were stored down at the lake. There was no shortage of trees for building and for burning. There were plenty of nails, though they were twisted and burnt. It did not take long to assess the cons. Under the existing circumstances, there were none. So they went to work. While Ralph cut trees, Auntie Evelyn sifted the ashes and saved every nail, which she straightened as best she could. They set the logs upright around the concrete slab, leaving one door and cutting out one window. They felled a large cedar tree, and Auntie Evelyn split out shakes with a furrow with which They sided the outside of the building and shingled the roof, using the burnt nails. The windows were indeed intact down at the lake, and one was brought up and used. The door was made of a few slabs, sawn lengthwise with a whip saw, and leather hinges were made. A narrow bunk for each of them was built, just under the eaves on either side of the stove. They still had not spent the $1.35. The finishing touch. Auntie Evelyn bought a roll of blue felt paper, remember that awful stuff, with which she covered the log walls on the inside. This both insulated the wall and enlivened the decor. They lived there that winter. A little store down at the lake supplied Auntie Evelyn with wool and gave her necessary groceries in return for knitted mitts and socks for the lumberjacks. Ralph trapped their meat and even sold a few skins. Many years later, I went along with Auntie Evelyn up to the lake, and we climbed to her little cabin. There it stood, decrepit, yes, the felt paper faded and torn, and the door hanging by one hinge, but still displaying the worth and ingenuity of a woman who conquered circumstances from which most of us would have fled in utter disintegration. It is not known how long Evelyn and Ralph lived in the cabin they built at Seymour Arm in 1929. At some point, they moved back to Kelowna. Evelyn physically built two or more homes around Kelowna. She sold these houses and was better off than she had ever been. Evelyn died in 1979 at the age of 97.
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmon Arm branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026. Or email info@voiceofthesushwap.ca. Discovering and sharing Shuswap history.
This radio program was made possible by a Government of Canada New Horizons grant, helping celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary.